I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello. You're listening to the Guitar Nerds Podcast, the world's number one guitar podcast. Wherever you're listening to us, we hope you're enjoying our little foray into the world of guitars. And remember, if you want more, patreon.com/guitar nerds, where you can enjoy an extra half an hour episode every week. Anyway, do enjoy this week's episode. Ha ha! Hello and welcome to another episode of the Guitar Nerds Podcast, the world's number one guitar podcast. I am your host, Joe Branton, joined this week by Mark Packham.
It's in the computer.
And Matthew Knight.
Hello there.
Yes, that's right. It's just the three of us this week. No J Cross, but that's okay.
Wasn't that the same as last week?
Was it three? No.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
was it?
No,
Jay
last
wasn't
week.
Here this week?
No, that's okay. When we had the incident with the pizza man trying to deliver the pizzas
to the wrong place.
Probably about 40 minutes across town.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Yeah. Did you put the wrong address in?
No.
It was the right address. He just decided to go to a completely different place and try and deliver them there.
That was the second delivery man as well. The first pizza, that didn't even turn up. And then the guy was like, yeah, we couldn't find it, got lost. How can you get lost in an age of sat-nav? Like, it really upset me because I couldn't understand it. I couldn't make sense of that situation. I don't understand how that happens.
Also in a town that is like 2 miles across.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
He was completely in the wrong place.
And J Cross lives like on the seafront. Like, it's just one road. It's just there.
Literally from where he had to go, it was one road and then take a right-hand turn and he would have been at Jay's house.
Anyway, needless to say that particular pizza place almost became not our go-to pre-podcast pizza place off the back of that.
You could have had a good pun with needless to say. You could have put need into a pizza. I was trying to think of the actual pun.
Needless. Yeah, very good. It was good pizza, but if we were thrown off last week, if last week seemed a different caliber of podcast, that's why. It's because we had
to
wait.
Did you think it was? I thought
it was fine. We had to wait an hour and 30 minutes
for a pizza that
should have taken 15 minutes.
I ordered something once from literally down the road, and they gave up halfway through delivering it. It took an hour and a half, and when I phoned them, I said, like, where is it? They went, oh, we just forgot. I'm like, thanks. And then it eventually turned up and someone had eaten half the chips, so...
Oh, my goodness.
Needless to say, we never went there again. Could have walked there and picked it up in the time, but we were just not bothered. I think it might be raining.
I took a 40-minute train ride yesterday to buy a curry.
Did you go to the Raj?
No, I did not go to the Raj. I went to a place called Shout out to Blue India in Crawley. It was good. It was
to Crawley for a curry.
Yeah, I was meeting up with my mate whose wedding is in a couple of weeks to talk about the what I need to do as an usher, and he was like, "Oh no, really good. I could come to Brighton, but really good curry place in Crawley. Should we go there?" And I was like, "Yeah, fine."
No one ever wants to go to Crawley.
I actually thought you meant you went to Crawley to get it, then went back to Brighton to eat it.
That'd be ridiculous. That'd be ridiculous.
Anyway, it is fast approaching summer NAM, which actually means for the first time in a long time, there have been lots of things released, which is good because there's actually tons of stuff to to talk about in the news section, which is good. Yeah, there's there's actually a podcast. But Matt, it's that Toman event again, and you headed along this weekend just gone.
I did. I got to hang out with all my friends, all my internet friends, the best of the internet, minus guitar nerds.
Yeah.
Joe's not allowed back to Germany.
Joe's not allowed back.
There's a slight ban on me over there at the moment.
He was too drunk. Yeah, so I got to hang out with Ryan. I shot a video with Ryan, which he...
60-cycle chump.
60-cycle chump, because he basically was ribbing me the entire time because he was like, oh, welcome to 60-cycle hum, the number one guitar-based podcast. And was like, there's pretty much no other podcast that exists. So, you know, we're the best one. And I'm like, yep.
And you can't say anything because you've got your boss hat on at that point.
Yeah, I got my boss hat on. My bigger, more important, actually, equally as important boss
hat. It's the hat that's filled with your wages.
My other hat is sort of rather ragged.
Yeah.
No pennies from that one.
Nothing's been left in that cap.
Yeah. So, I got to see Ryan and Colin from CS Guitars, Patrick Hunter, who does a Wicked Bass Channel, Hunter, who does a YouTube channel called Agufish, and he's a really cool dude. And then who else was there? Jay Leonard J, who's like one of... He's got a really small YouTube channel, but he's literally one of the best guitar players I've seen.
Yeah, he's a really super tasteful guitarist.
Yeah,
when I first saw his channel, I was like, that might be the most hipster man I've ever seen. And I almost didn't watch any of it just off of the back of that alone.
But I mean, actually, Joe, he's you're the most tasteful. Hipster man I've ever seen.
Your experience of hipster is very, very slim because you still look, dress like, and hang out with the same people you did when you were 12. But
yeah, 100%.
But I'm on a scale of hipster. He wears headbands. That's way more hipster. But he's actually a fantastic guitarist.
He is an amazing guitar player. Got to hang out with Pete Cottrell, who's also got an amazing YouTube channel. They were filming some cool videos with some wireless kit, which was cool. And who else was there? Steve from Boston was there, formerly
Pixie Licks.
Yeah, who's got the best voice for radio ever.
He really does. I did
the best voice. I could just listen to him talk just because he's got the best voice.
I did an episode with him a couple of years ago, and yeah, he's just... I can't do the Boston twang, but he's just got that proper sort of gravelly deep. He's like what I want Santa Claus to be.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And then, yeah, the Mick and Dan from that pedal show were there. Just hang out with them, spoke to Pete Thorne for a little bit. So, you know, it was good to just catch up with everyone and take a bunch of cool gear down and let people try a bunch of stuff and met some new people as well. So, yeah, it was good. And the weather was insanely good for the 2 days that I was there. My other colleague is still there now. He was there for the last 2 days. But when I was there, it was like 27 degrees.
Outrageous.
And they had built this massive tent in the parking lot in front of the store, which overlooked this really nice like mini lake. So when it was quiet, we got to just sit in deck chairs and enjoy the sun for a little bit, which was good.
That's all right for some, isn't it? Getting paid for that. Having a great old time.
I mean, I still had to get up at like... I did get up at 6 a.m. both days I was there. Once to... run with Mary Spender, the second time to run with Mary Spender, who then didn't show up.
Little competitive running rivalry going on there. You had to get the dig in.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I said 7, she said 6:30, and then she was like, no, it's definitely 6:30. So I was like, right, I'll get up and get there for 6:30. Got there 6:30, waited 15 minutes, no show, went for a run, came back. I was like, where were you? She's like, oh, I decided to start at 7. I was like...
So, trying to in some way make some of the first 10 minutes of this podcast about guitars, could you talk about any of the gear that you saw?
No. Actually, I did hang out with...
You had a great curry.
Did I have a curry?
Unbelievable.
I didn't have a curry. No. I did actually hang out with a chap called Ron Thorne, who knows J Cross, so that's a bad start. And he's a master builder at Fender. He's one of the newer master builders at Fender. So I got to
he's the fellow who did the Game of Thrones guitars, isn't he?
Yes, I think he is. Yeah. So he's been at Fender for how long did he say? I think he's been at Fender for like well over 10 years. But he's known for doing all the inlay work. He's like the inlay master. And then he's sort of been promoted to a master builder. So they had some stuff. They had a guitar that he built there, which was a 64. This really nice, like, relic 64 Strat. So it was cool to hang out with him. I spent a long time talking to a chap called Guillaume. He was the engineer and president of Two Notes.
Really?
Yeah, so I spent a lot of time talking to him about the Two Note stuff. We were talking about the Cav M, because that's a really cool product. That's the newer version of the Torpedo cab that we were using for the Guitar Nerds videos, you know, a couple of years ago. And this is the much smaller version with the digital screen for IR loading for your pedal board, basically. And we were talking with him, and I forget his name, but the other guy who works for Rev. So Rev were there. They bought the D20, so I got to try the D20 for a bit.
Oh, wicked.
And that was a super cool amp, single channel. We spoke about it on the podcast.
Do you remember, Mark? I don't think you liked the chassis.
Oh, yeah, it's the one that looked like a...
It's a black box, kind of, a lunch box.
It looks wicked. It comes in a wicked packaging, and they do it in black or white, and I thought it looked really wicked.
I think it looks like the obelisk from 2001 Space Odyssey.
Great. You've just described a perfect object. that was cool. Spoke to the new guy at Yamaha. So we were talking about some Yamaha guitars. They had some nice Revstars there.
I'm still really excited to see what happens with Ampeg now that they've been taken under the Yamaha fold. They're sort of, it's been almost long enough now that there should be some sort of announcement. I don't know how long they're going to sit on that for.
96 Ampeg. Put an insane mode on an Ampeg, that's what you need.
Matt, you laugh, but I'm pretty sure that when they did the Lowdown series...
They did, it did have an Lowdown, insane
I think it had an insane series. And you say did Ampeg, it? They had, not only did they have the combos, but they did have a rack-mountable head that looked a bit like an SVT-4. I think it was called the
LD-400,
maybe?
It was a big...
Maybe 2 or 3U. No, it's probably like a 3 or 4U even rack mountable, like silver fronted head that kind of had a bit of an Ampeg vibe to it. Cool. But yeah, it was Line 6 and it had like, I think it was LD-400 for some reason.
I can't remember what it was called. I do remember that there was a... I can't remember. There was a band that used one, a relatively big band, and I was shocked that their bass player was still using one. Obviously, this story only works if I can remember that band. There you go. A band at one point used that amplifier.
Good to know.
Just looking at the Lowdowns, I was trying to find a decent picture of the front panel. So you had five modes, which included synth. I think these were like near the end of the life cycle by the time that I started working in the shop. I don't think they could have been around much longer.
Yeah, it was weird because, I mean, I think bass combos, generally speaking, are a bit of an odd thing. I know plenty of companies still make them at a starter level, but it's still a really weird thing. Those Line 6 Lowdowns, though, I remember that they did like a 300-watt version, I think, which was there.
I think there
probably
was
their loudest.
I think there was a 150, a 300, and a 400, and then the 400 also came in the head version, the HD-400.
I'm looking at it now. So you had amp models. Let's have a look here. You had clean, rock, Brit, grind, and synth.
Yeah, grind was like kind of the insane mode of that amp, and then the synth was like
Why was there a synth mode but why would you ever just want a synth? I guess it's foot switchable. I guess the whole thing's foot switchable.
Yeah, there was definitely foot switches available for it.
I can't remember what foot switches they... I think it's probably the same foot switch as the other one. Oh, and there was an R&B mode for when you wanted to go between R&B and grind. Weird. Smart effects, that's what it was called. Oh, and it had a compressor.
Of course.
I'm guessing it had the same synth sound as the FM4s. It's probably had the same synth engine.
I don't think it was even that advanced. It was just, it had a synth sound.
The grind was based on a Sansamp PSA-1 into an SVT with a clean bass direct signal mixed in.
Yeah,
sure it was. Yeah, of course. But it sounded just like it.
Yeah, they had... So Clean was based on an Eden Traveller. R&B was a 68 flip-top B15. The Rock was a 74 Ampeg SVT. The Brit was a 68 Marshall Super Bass. So there you go.
Classic.
Go out and get a
second-hand
one. Don't worry, they were $500 new.
They'll probably be about £1 now.
Not now they've talked about them on the podcast. Everyone's going to want
one. Value. Yeah. So my friend is, at the moment, he's like about to move or thinking about moving house and needs a bit more kind of space in his house. And he is looking to lease or like let someone borrow his Flextone 3 combo. And classic. if I hadn't have just classic. Bought that the Katana, I would have absolutely had the Flextone for a bit.
Underrated piece of equipment right there.
I mean, the Flextone 3s are not great. The Flextone 2 is an amp that I've got fond memories of, but the Flextone 3 I think sounds not fantastic. But I would have if I had the chance to borrow one for a bit, I would have absolutely have taken him up on it.
For the longest time, the Flextone 3 was actually my bass amp round my guitarist's house for when we went round there and just sort of sat in, you know, in a room and practiced. I just went through his old Flextone 3.
Weren't they like the pod in that they had the tube preamp mode, which didn't have any kind of like guitar amp modeling on it? It was supposed to be like a kind of channel strip. So it was, supposed to, you could put in an acoustic or like a microphone or a bass or something and it would sound okay.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure what setting I used. I tried to make it sound as clean as possible, you know, which is tricky. But yeah, it was an awful product. Yeah, it's fine. But I mean, yeah. You know, I was plugging a bass into it anyway. So this weekend, whilst you were in Germany, Matty, I went up to London for Portals Festival, a festival of experimental rock, as it is as it's known, at the Tufnell Dome, which is lovely, a wonderful sort of 1,000-cap-ish venue. But they have three stages because the Tufnell Dome also has the Boston Music Rooms beneath it. And then you've got Aces and Eights, which is a bar across the road. So you've got like 1,000-cap, a 500-cap, and a little 100-cap. And they put on bands all day across the weekend with all of those, with such wonderful headliners as McCluskey, who are always fantastic to see for a load of weird gear. Their new bass player, who is the front guy in St. Pierre's Snake Invasion, plays...
What?
They're a great band. You should check them out. But he plays... He's left-handed and he plays a right-handed P bass, you know, with the strings the wrong way round. But also, because he's doing a lot of chords, and I guess they're always roughly around the same key, for about half of the set, he puts tape over, like, under three of the strings, but over one of them to fret the string down at a particular point on the neck.
Okay.
How good is that?
Why don't you just buy a bass capo?
Well, because, mate, I don't know. I couldn't tell you. But I thought it was a great idea. Oh, I was thoroughly enjoying that. But it was a wonderful event for sort of, you know, weird...
Wait, it's a pink bass as well?
It's white. It's white.
Just
it's
this photo made it look pink.
Probably.
That's a shame.
But,
I was going to be into them then for a second.
Yeah, but so I was... preparing to go up on the weekend. I bumped into Mark Packham just after I'd finished my rehearsal, because of course, listener, as you'll know, I've been purchasing Music Masters. I got the Squire Music Master bass and the Fender Music Master, the 77 recently. So I was all ready for those. Took the 77 to rehearsal. You know, I got a nice custom set of Newtone strings on there, really heavy gauge strings, so that I can get it down into drop C. Anyway, I'm playing at practice, and I'm just not getting enough volume off of my, like, low C. It's just sounds a bit compressed. And I know it's a guitar pickup in there, and I'm like, well, I don't know. It just didn't sound very aggressive. And I'm sort of looking at the bridge, and I was thinking, well, maybe I could, lower. You've only got those two saddles, so it's a bit of a balancing game. But I was like, maybe I can sort of lower the, you know, what would normally be the E string a little bit, maybe put it a bit closer to the pickup, see if that helps in any way. And I sort of what's weird is you need a flathead for that bridge. But so I was like, well, I'll lower it a little bit. Got the screwdriver in there, gave it a turn, and the entire bridge collapsed. And I realised that actually, it was rusted sort of into that position. But the actual the sort of the screws were completely threaded, as it were. So there was there was no way of adjusting it. And of course, then it was slap up against the body. So I had no bass. And that was after about sort of 20 minutes of rehearsal. So that was was fun.
The joys of vintage instruments.
Exactly. That is the joys of vintage instruments. Fortunately, I always bring two basses to practice, so I was okay. But
what was the other bass?
My trusty jazz bass. I've got the Mexican nitro finished 60s jazz bass.
Classic.
Just get a fan fretted 7-string Dingle.
Well, maybe.
And then
I should.
Sell all of it and just buy a almost new American Precision, and then pocket the rest of the money, because all you will ever need is a American Precision from the last 10 years.
Well, I really enjoyed recording on the 69 Precision bass, but I have to say, as my second experience now sort of trying to gig a vintage, because of course the 69 didn't make it through a show before the nut broke, and the 77 Music Master didn't make it through a practice before the bridge broke. So I think I've come to the conclusion that whilst I really like vintage instruments, I also really like being able to play a whole gig. So I played on the weekend, and it was fantastic. I threw myself around. It's a really good show. Had loads of fun playing on my jazz basses. I brought both my jazzes and had a couple of different tunings, so I have to switch between. And I was just like, oh, what am I doing at the moment? Why am I on this Music Master kick? These jazz basses are great. I think I'm actually, because Mark, you've been saying recently about you selling all your gear, keeping the Katana and having like the one guitar, having this minimal setup and how good that was. I'm like, maybe I'll sell all my gear.
Basically, what you've just said is that the latest Joe Branton fad is winding down, which is something we could have all predicted about 2 weeks ago when you accidentally bought a Squire Music Master on eBay, which you definitely didn't need. Mm. That was like the beginning of the end, but it was also the beginning of the fad. So it was this one's been basically over before it even started.
Oh, possibly.
All I'm telling you is just get yourself an American-made precision bass. And
well,
just
I've got two precisions. I've got two precisions. I've got two jazzes. They're fine. So I'll just keep those four, plus the Stonefield.
Don't forget that brand that you endorsed. Don't forget about them.
Yeah, the brand you endorsed that you said you'd never need to replace as your gigging bass. When was the last time you did a gig with that one, Joe?
I don't know. When did I do that advert for Boss?
Matt's probably best place to answer that.
Two years ago.
No, wait.
No, it's April.
I thought you were talking about the DC2.
Oh, right. No, I brought another different bass for that, didn't I? I brought the little Gibson short scale hollow body Les Paul bass.
And are the guys at Stonefield still talking to you?
I sold that. Well, I haven't spoken to them in a while. I'm sure if I messaged them, they would still talk to me.
Get yourself a Stinger and be done with it.
Yeah, those Stingers were
best
fantastic. Stonefield Stinger starts at the 12th fret. That's what you want. A 6-string bass that starts at the 12th fret.
That's a guitar, mate.
Well, it's a bass.
Sure.
Stonefield Stinger. They're absolutely fantastic. But anyway,
talking about American-made Fenders and stuff. On this, on the trip back from this curry the other night, I was with with someone else who, he's just one of my mates who's a guitar player, and he was talking about, kind of sorting out his collection and, what he should do with it and stuff. And he's got an American Strat from maybe 2009 or something. And we were kind of talking about it, and I was just saying, those guitars, and I think we've talked about this maybe on the podcast.
I'm pretty sure you.
Weeks.
I know what you're going to say, and I'm sure last week you went off on
a
big
tangent.
Maybe
I've got a real
this.
Thing in my bonnet, like a bee in my bonnet at the moment
for the most boring average.
No. Just that sort of guitar in general, like guitars that were made about sort of 10 years ago.
Right.
American-made guitars that you can pick up for no money now. Like I saw on the site on Reverb today, something popped up, a Gibson Les Paul special, like the one that you've got, Matty.
Yeah.
In that one of the warm finishes.
Matt's got an SG special.
That's what I meant, SG special. £350.
Oh, and outrageous.
Compare that to what you could get if you spent £350 new now. What would you get? You'd get maybe an Epiphone G400.
Yeah.
How much are they? Maybe they're maybe £250. But I mean, even so, what's the next jump up? I guess it's the next Gibson model.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Gibson have hurt themselves over the last few years by releasing a new range of guitars every year, especially when, you know, they are willing to put together an American guitar and retail it for like $699. You know, when they're willing to go that low, that of course means that, you know, give it 5 years, the secondhand market is going to be absolutely saturated, as it is with all these like mid-tier Gibsons. But of course, because there are so many, yeah, you put $350-$400 for an American, mate, for anything with Gibson on the headstock, I'd be happy with that.
Well, totally. And, you know, I've seen a couple of those LPJs come up on there as well, which were not particularly expensive at the time. What were they, like $600, roughly?
$699, I think.
$699. You can get those for like under $400. And it's an American-made Les Paul. Yeah, it's got the worn finish and it's got those cheaper plastic pickups in it. But, you know, you could buy some bare knuckles for, you know, $100-ish. And you'd have a guitar that would just be absolutely amazing for like no money.
I don't necessarily think the same thing is happening with Fender, though. It's happening to an extent. I mean, but if you think, I think those like secondhand mid-2000s American-made Strats, Tellys, P basses, jazz basses, they've always been, they're like 650. 650, 700 quid. That's kind of what they go for, secondhand.
I'm not, that's what they've
gone for the last like 5-6 years.
But what I'm saying is, you know, compare that as in the value of like against a new one, you know, great, you know. It's brilliant to get a new guitar, but, you know, those guitars are, you know, American professionals are well up over $1,000 now.
Well, I guess the reincarnation of Fender that we've seen over the last 2 years is kind of the first time we've seen a price hike, really, in Fender.
I wouldn't say that's particularly true, because I think, you know, prices on that stuff, you know, across the board, not just Fender, have been going up all the time. But luckily, you know, the secondhand prices have stayed fairly static. You know, I would say that, you know, maybe a few years ago when I was working in the shop, an American Strat would sell for maybe $550, that kind of money. And you can pretty much, if you get the right deal, you could still get a kind of mid-2000s American Strat for about $550.
Kind of makes me want to get a mid-2000s Strat.
Totally. Well, this is this conversation on the train home. I was like, oh, maybe I don't really need a Strat, but I could just get a Strat. And I had a look, and there's like a couple of like, do you remember like the candy cola finish ones?
I really liked that. Yeah. That was a great finish.
I mean, you did just pick the worst finish.
No,
but
how is that the worst finish?
Again, this, you know, this comes back to when I bought my bass. My bass was incredibly cheap when I bought it because
the finish is probably the worst color Fender has ever committed
to. It's a great color, but people have bad taste and they don't like the Sunset Orange Transparent. I would, like now, if you pick up like a candy cola, you know, not particularly popular color, if you negotiate with someone, you could get that for sub $600, and that is a lot of guitar for sub $600.
I just buy an Olympic white one. Sorry, I'd have to go.
They're always more money. That's the thing. Yeah. The Olympic white ones are always more money. People want like $750 for them.
I could probably sell my American original Strat and get an old American standard from that time and probably pocket the best part of $400.
Well, maybe not that much, but you could pocket a bit, definitely, at least a couple $100.
Mm.
But there's bargains galore at the moment if you're looking at that stuff. You know, like I see like, you know, Baja Telly's going for sub $500. I see, you know, American Telly's going for sub $600.
I do like how since you've started working for Reverb, you've become the absolute authority on. Yeah, you're the authority on sort of on prices on the secondhand market at the moment. Maybe we should have like a new section in the podcast, which is like Mark's deal of the week.
Or how about this? The reverb.com deal of the week. No.
I'll send you over our rates card and maybe we'll something out.
I'm actually on Reverb's Fender American Standard Strat 1986 to 2000s category.
What are you finding?
There's a picture of one that I can't actually see. I think it's just the gallery picture, but it's in that amazing Hot Rod red.
Yeah, yeah. Good finish.
Wait, what's Hot Rod red? Hot Rod red?
It basically looks like a postbox.
Yeah.
So an English postbox, for people who listen in America, is basically the same colour as a Ferrari?
It's not metallic.
It's
not
metallic. What's the Gibson version of that colour? It's got a great cardinal red.
Yeah, I would say cardinal red.
It's got a white undercoat, as far as I'm aware.
Yeah, it's a darker Fiesta red.
Oh, that sounds right up my street.
So there's a band from the punk scene who have actually just got back together called The Briefs. And when I played with them back in the day, the bass player had a Hot Rod Red Maple Neck P bass, and it was like, this is such a good looking guitar.
Yeah, that sounds cool.
Yeah, it's a great color. They only did it for like maybe a year, something like that. It was like they were limited edition, the Hot Rod Red ones. But yeah, I mean, like I was saying, you know, it's just because I'm around these kind of listings and these guitars all day long. But yeah, I'm spotting some real kind of bargains at the moment, like in different price points and different from different brands and stuff. And definitely the Fender American stuff from 10 to 15 years ago is not like rising as quickly as other stuff. So you can still pick up a really good bargain.
Yeah. Deals to be had. Guys, should we do some news, seeing as there's loads to do?
Well, there's nothing in the mailbag, is there?
There's nothing in the mailbag this week. No, I haven't been sort of heckling brands as much, you know, over the last week or so.
I'll tell you what, now's a good time. If you've got a brand, now is a great time before Summer NAMM to get a product to us, and you'll get extensive coverage on the podcast, because people are not sending us stuff right now because they're holding it back for NAMM. But if you've got something that you want to, you know, get to us before NAMM, now would be the time to basically get some airtime.
Absolutely. Here's the news. News. First up, Matt Bellamy. I really hate him.
You're not allowed to talk for the next 5 minutes, Joe.
No, fine. Sorry. You're doing this one.
Okay, so big news this week from the world of guitars. Matt Bellamy, frontman, guitar player of Muse, has become the majority shareholder in Manson Guitar Works. So Manson's a luthier based down in Exeter, I believe, Devon. And they have been making Matt Bellamy's guitars I guess nearly 20 years. When's that first Muse album? 99?
Did they make guitars for him back then?
No, not on the first album. But
no,
like,
but I think I'm pretty sure that he, because they're from that area, that he went to Manson's as a kid.
Yeah, that was like
his stuff from Manson's. I think that was like his local guitar shop.
Yeah, yeah, right, definitely, definitely. And then, so when Muse started taking off, he worked with the guys at Manson's to create, you know, his crazy guitars that had the chaos pad and the, you know, touch pads and all that kind of stuff in. So yeah, he has basically bought the company. He's become the majority shareholder. What I find interesting about this is, you know, Manson's has always had this great name as this real boutique custom shop where, you know, you can go and get anything made.
But not just that, Manson's have serviced sort of some of the biggest players. You know, if you think, you know, that Mikey Demas recently got his own really gorgeous signature model from there. We've got like Dave Grohl.
John Paul Jones has his signature 12-string
bass. Yeah, of course,
bass.
John Paul Jones has his... He has a normal bass as well, just a normal... It's not 12-string, it's an 8, the John Paul Jones, I think.
Oh, is it? I thought it was a 12. Either way.
It's an 8. There's a picture of it on Music Radio right strings. Now. I mean, what I think is exciting about this is, you know, it'll be interesting to see what his plans for it are, because, you know, I kind of...
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found. That project manager I could never seem to hire? And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Understand that the ethos behind a real small boutique custom shop workshop. And, you know, if you're the, so the previous owner was Hugh Manson. And, you know, if you're the luthier and the owner, really probably his interest is in building cool little guitar, you know, cool guitars, custom shop things, weird projects, that kind of thing. And I imagine, you know, they were getting enough business through the kind of Matt Bellamy link. But obviously, in, you know, in recent years, they've licensed out some of the designs to Cort, who have been making the affordable versions of the Matt Bellamy guitar. So it seems like they've been toying with the idea of doing more. So it'd be really interesting for me to see if Matt Bellamy's going to come in and say, right, we're, you know, we're going to hook up with, you know, the Cort factory and start doing a whole line of guitars with Manson on the headstock. Maybe. Plus, we're going to do a range of British-built guitars that aren't just the signature models.
Yeah, it would be great to see an expansion of them. I mean, they're certainly like fantastic quality guitars.
Well, definitely. And you know, we saw some of the Cort models at, I forget which one of the guitar shows, and I was really impressed by the build quality and, you know, how they'd managed to translate some of the design cues from the Manson guitars down into these Cort models. Yeah. So yeah, that's what's exciting for me. And, you know, as much as I don't think anyone on the podcast is a particular fan of Muse, maybe Matty.
I like the first two records.
Yeah. And, you know, I know that, Joe, you've got particular beef with Matt Bellamy himself. But, you know, I think you play up to that. That's your character.
Just as a little bit of info here from the Muse Wiki.
Yeah.
He owns 50 different Manson instruments.
Wow.
Going back to 2001.
Right.
Was the first one.
Blimey, that's got to be pretty early in the... in the old Muse.
Well, I think that's probably just before Origin of Symmetry, I think, probably.
Is that the second album?
That's the second album.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's the exciting thing for me is, you know, what's the company going to do now? Is it going to transition from being a custom shop through to, you know, being someone that's a kind of real British guitar brand, but not just making guitars in the UK? You know, something that like Chapman Guitars are doing, where they are, you know, they're now building some high-end stuff in the UK, but obviously they're building some really nice stuff out in Korea.
They're so perfectly geared up to do something like that, though. It would be really exciting to see them kind of, you know, expand outside of that. Oh,
I thought what was interesting as well is I've seen posts from Manson setting up a booth outside of the gigs that they've been playing recently. So they've been selling, you know, high-end Matt Bellamy's and Mikey Dima's guitars straight after the Muse show. So I'm sure a few high-end Matt Bellamy guitars go at the end of every show.
You've
got to think, if they're playing in front of like 50,000 people, I'm sure one or two of those people has got enough disposable income to walk away with a guitar as the ultimate piece of merchandise from the end of a gig.
Do you reckon it's like the Gene Simmons thing where you can buy one of the used on stage ones?
I just think that's so genius.
Well, yeah, I mean, Kiss fans are crazy.
It's a good marketing.
I mean, for a start, they like Kiss.
Yeah.
So it's just a problem. Really excited to see where this goes, and be interesting to see another kind of British guitar brand kind of entering the mainstream.
We're back on the guitar front, which is good.
Now we just need what were they called? Maverick guitars to make a comeback. That's the dream. The weird pointy things from the early 2000s.
Oh, yeah. I guess we have had a few come back recently because what's
Shergold?
I was going to say we've got Shergold back. Gordon Smith are back. Chapman are going from strength to strength. We need Burns to really get their act together. They're sort of... they're falling away a little bit at the moment. Their website doesn't look like it's been updated since, well, to be honest, since, you know, people stopped using paper and pen.
But, that's how you get their website, just get it delivered.
Yeah, they really do need to sort it out because they, you know, obviously Burns Guitars are cool. I'm just on the Manson like mod shop thing that they have on here. Do you know you can get, you know, they do a... they do their Evo guitar with a Sustainiac pickup and a built-in Fuzz Factory.
Yeah. Well, didn't a lot of the Matt Bellamy guitars have a built-in Fuzz Factory, I think?
I thought the Bellamy ones had a built-in Chaos Pad.
Well,
They don't actually have, like... they don't actually have the Chaos Pad itself built in. What they have is the touchpad, XY touchpad, which then sends a MIDI out into the Chaos Pad off stage, as far as I'm aware. And then they had a built-in Fuzz Factory. Because I think for a while, if I remember right, you could buy the Fuzz Factory in like a guitar kit form.
Right.
Really?
To build into a guitar, yeah.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah, considering it's got like five controls on it, it's kind of ridiculous, but I would definitely want one. His new guitar, actually, I was just reading here that for this new run of tour, they've had a new MIDI system built into his guitars that controls like some sort of mega profit synth off stage now with like zero latency.
So ridiculous.
You know, at least he's pushing the boundaries of what guitars do.
Oh, exactly. You know the expression, all the gear. Anyway, moving on.
You say that, none of these things that he has done would be things that I would put past you doing in your own band. Like, I can absolutely see you being like, oh, boys, yeah, I've just found this boutique luthier. They're going to build a bass for me for, you know, it's going to be my only gig in bass. And it's got, you know, six strings and they're all doubled. So it's actually a 12 string. Plus there's like a MIDI keyboard built in with a touchpad. I'd be like, yeah, that sounds pretty spot on.
I think... what's his name from Muse has a bass almost exactly as you described. I think that's where he plays some sort of.
He's got a status with a built-in keyboard.
Yeah, hasn't he got a double neck status with a keyboard built in as well?
I don't think the double neck is the one with the keyboard built in, but he has a lot of weird statuses.
I can see you owning all of these things either way.
Fine. Yes, it's application of the instrument. You know,
I'll tell that to multi-millionaire mega rock god Matt Bellamy. I'll let him know that you've got some tips from him. When's he coming around to your bedsit so that you can school him on the ways that he should be playing.
They do actually make, so he has two double neck states, a fretless and a fretted, and then one does have a touchpad with the digital guitar side and then the bass side. So they make a double neck, but yeah, one is a normal bass and then one is a weird synth bass.
Oh, absolutely ridiculous.
Exactly what you need. Anyway, Joyo have released a Velcro-free pedal board. Well, it's not actually being branded as Joyo. It's their sister company, Gitto.
Oh, Joyo.
Yeah, Gitto. unfortunately named Gitto have released their own pedal boards that don't have Velcro. Now we've seen this sort of thing. This isn't, you know, completely original because of course is it a clam? They did it as well, didn't they? Remember, we got their cinnamon drive through and it comes, all their pedals are built in. Are built with, you know, that the, I mean, the clamps built in.
Same pedal board, basically.
It's exactly the same idea. But really cool for people who don't want to use Velcro. It's actually a great way of doing it. You have little connectors that allow you to sort of clamp in any pedal of any size onto a board, and they do it with a range of soft cases as well.
I think the advantage for this, because saying it's for people who don't want to use Velcro, that's a problem that doesn't exist.
Yeah,
I think.
Of course. Yeah.
But I think where there is a problem, which comes up quite a lot, is people who want to use mini pedals and they don't fit on things like pedal trains properly because of the spacing, or
that's
you have to put them in a weird position. So this allows you to mount a mini pedal better. And then what's also nice is, as I always say, your foot is still the same size. So butting up a bunch of mini pedals together is pointless because you're going to step on about three at once.
That's what a guy from a pedal company who doesn't make mini pedals says. No, but I actually agree.
What this does is it does actually space out your pedals more, I guess. If you want to use a bunch of mini pedals, you can still have four or five and then leave enough space for you still to be able to step on them individually, but then I don't have to worry about them wobbling about, because sometimes mini pedals, they just wobble from side to side because they're just not stable enough.
The other problem I see this solving is if you've got the issue that Matt Knight's got, where he wants to just change stuff around all the time, it means that you're not like constantly... Because what I found, if I change stuff on my pedal board, is if you put Velcro on there, eventually the glue from the Velcro to the back of the pedal wears off, because the Velcro is like so strong. And if you're moving stuff around all the time, eventually that will just like come off. Whereas this, if you're moving stuff regularly, it's not too much of an issue.
Yeah, 100%. I've actually, I can't find the prices on them. I imagine that these are going to be super affordably priced, the ghetto.
Just trying to find a price for you right now.
I've been doing, I said recently, I've been looking at a lot of like custom pedal boards, like Rourke and Pistola.
Pardon?
Pistola, as in a gun, you know, Pistola.
Sure.
And Creation Boards, Boyce Box, Stage Tricks, V Boutique, a Soul Man, who we've spoken about before, Hellweg.
Trailer Trash?
Clayton Trailer Trash, I looked at those. A ton of them. A ton of sort of different people doing those sorts of things at the moment that I've just been having the butchers out. Honestly, until I got interested in pedal boards like this, I didn't realise how many there are out there. And of course, there are any subtle differences from brand to brand. And you know, the bulk of them tend to be gorgeously sort of Tolex mounted or like a lovely polished bit of wood. But there are a ton of options out there. But my goodness, aren't they all expensive?
Yeah. I mean, oh, we've spoke about it before, but I think one of the good ones, you know, and I've still got, is the Wagi pedal boards.
Yes.
Because they're tiered, they're relatively inexpensive, they've got good cable management underneath. They're just tricky to get in the UK at the moment. That's the only problem. But it's interesting. I think we spoke about it a few months ago, maybe even longer, when we were talking about, there was a time where there was basically one company, and that was... based in America, and there was a guy who was doing like relict pedal boards and stuff like that as well. And then they sort of basically just like disappeared. And like people were like, nah, just keep using Pedal Train. And now like the market's like totally exploded and everyone's doing something.
Of course. And to be honest, you know, the issue that Pedal Train are gonna come up against as this part of the market seems to be expanding is their flight cases aren't really fit for flying. You know, they're not good enough to survive the sort of things that happen to flight cases full of really heavy pedals when they're being moved onto and off of a plane and being thrown around in the same manner that someone would lob a suitcase onto a cart. The Pedal Train ones don't. Certainly for me, either of the couple of times I've had to fly boards, the Pedal Trains have cracked every time.
I always thought the case that came with the Pedal Train Junior was pretty solid. I don't know if it's different to the case that comes with the Pro.
So the Junior one is, that one is right. And I think at that sort of size, it's probably fine. But as soon as you start expanding onto the sort of the Novo 24, 32s, things like that, and they just have the same frame, but more of the very thin wood that they're using for the rest of it, and that, you know, that metal case isn't getting any thicker. Just from experience, both times the pedal boards have cracked, where, you know, flight cases for other things do not, you know. But it will be interesting to see if they can keep their market share in a place where there are so many pedal board manufacturers now. The trick is that no pedal board manufacturers want to drop their prices, and so there's such a big difference between, you know, spending 150 quid on a pedal train and spending...
I think what you've got to remember though is that Pedal Train, the same with Boss and the same with a lot of other big brands, is they're in like hundreds of dealers. So in the heat of a moment, you can go into a store and buy a Pedal Train. But if you want something custom, you obviously have to order that custom. But there's a bunch of other great brands like Pedal Train, that are doing stuff similar that's more readily available. I'm really into the Warwick ones, the Rock boards, because they come with those optional modules that you can buy.
Oh yeah. Just when you talk about the Rock boards, I just remember what they used to be like. The ones in like the classic big gig bags and stuff. They were just dreadful.
Yeah, but the more modern ones are really, really nice.
Yeah. I just remember a time when your only choices were, if you've got Boss pedals, you get a BCB 60, and if you don't have Boss pedals, you get one of the Warwick gig boards, and they're absolutely dreadful. Whereas now, you know, we're kind of there's so many options for these things on a budget level. You know, there's all the things like the Diagos. There's even now these Joyo ones. If you want to go and spend, you know, a grand or whatever on a pedal board, that option's available, which it wasn't really necessarily before.
There's one thing I'm quite interested to find out, just actually for my own personal knowledge, is when the BCB 60 was actually released, because I want to know how many other pedal boards were potentially available when the BCB 60 came out.
It's still in production, right?
It's still in production. I mean, we must be making the BCB 60, because before that it was the BCB 6. So I mean, the picture on the website has got a DD6 on it. And a GE20, which we haven't made for quite, and it's got like a TU12 needle tuner on it.
Classic. So I remember when we were at school, and one of my mates had a band, and he had a bit of a pedal board, and he had a couple of Boss pedals and stuff. And there were literally no pedal boards that he could buy at that point, so he had to make his own. And like, yeah, we were kind of looking magazines, and you just couldn't buy pedal boards in the way that you can now. Like, even if you walk into, you know, a shop that's kind of as sort of mass appeal as somewhere like GAC, you know, a big kind of superstore, they'll have probably four or five different brands of pedal board. And then obviously if you go online, you know, there's tons of boutique options, there's things that you can kind of design yourself, get spec'd, whatever you want. But yeah, this is only, you know, 20 years ago, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was literally not a pedal board that he could buy. He had to buy it for the power supply. He had to go to Maplin's and buy one of those, like, you know, 50 quid. I don't know what it was called. It was called, like, Rockman or something. And it was, like, really noisy and rubbish, non-isolated power supply. And he had to basically bolt that to just a bit of wood that we sort of found and then bolt his pedals to that. Or I think he did actually Velcro them. But, like, it's amazing how much that has changed.
I reckon. I wonder how many, like, you know, listeners, I wonder how many of us actually built our own boards, you know, if you go back to 10, 20 years. I'm sure I've told this story
before, but way back when I first got into guitar playing, there was a forum called Guitar Geek. Do you remember that forum?
Yeah,
I do not.
And I don't think it exists anymore, but they did those wicked, like, rig pictures that were like cartoons.
Yeah, they're still around. They're still around.
Because you see less of that, and I actually think that was always quite cool. I'm surprised no one ever built that into an app that you could actually build your own. And I actually built my own pedal board, and then I put a photo bucket album and description together and put it on that forum. And I think, I mean, I haven't checked it for like 10 years, but I think after like 2 or 3 years, it'd been viewed and downloaded like 50,000 times or something ridiculous.
What was on that board, Matt? Can you remember?
I've got a picture of it somewhere. I had a Crybaby.
Standard.
An MD2 Mega Distortion.
Yes.
A CH1, I think. What else did I have? I think it might have been when I had my Line 6 FM4. Maybe I need to find that picture somewhere on my computer, on my hard drive. I need to get out. I've got pretty much every pedal board I've ever built.
Oh, we need to see that combination.
What I'm trying to do is dig out every rig picture I've got, and load it onto the Facebook page, because I think that would be quite
definitely
interesting.
Yeah, make an album in the Facebook group. I would actually love to see that. As much as I kind of rip you for being like well nerdy about this stuff, I would actually really, really like to see that.
And I'll also find out when the BCB 60 came out. It was first listed on Amazon. Ah, here we go. 2003.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh my goodness.
So
2003.
So before that was the BCB 6. Before that, which had been at least 10 years. So I'm guessing probably like 1993.
Yeah.
Outrageous.
Yeah, I think when my mate built his, he didn't buy the BCB 6 because he had like a couple of like Russian electroharmonics pedals as well as his Boss stuff, and obviously they didn't really fit on there. Yeah. So yeah, that's why he like built his out of a plank that he found.
So my first pedal board I made when I was working at a DIY center, and I built myself one out of plywood, got a couple of handles, you know, from like the cupboard handle bit to be on either side of it. But I also built in a clock. So I made this a box, it was a thin hollow box, so it wasn't just a piece of wood. I made it a hollow box so that I could have the clock underneath the first layer, so it's just a screen showing.
Yeah,
it was so that, you know, I was thinking it's so I know how much longer I've got of my set. That's right.
Now you can actually buy an actual pedal that does that for you. So
yeah, you can. You can. But yeah, it was that I thought that would be something that I would need, you know.
Of course, when you were doing 8 Blink 182 covers in a set, there's a chance that you might overrun.
Yeah, sure.
BCB6 came out in the late 1980s.
Wow, there
what
we go.
What was around then? Pedal Train? I guess Pedal Train was 1990. I want to say, no, I'm thinking of Voodoo Labs. I think Voodoo Labs was 1994. I reckon Pedal Train's probably got to be early 2000s, right?
Yeah, definitely.
The history of pedal boards in 2 minutes. That's what we need.
That's the next
that's what
video.
We need from you.
That's the next video.
Great, wonderful. I'm sure it sounds really, really interesting. Anyway, Matt, talk to me about Morgan amps. You don't you still own a Morgan amp?
I do. Still my favourite amp. I absolutely love it.
Well, it won't be for much longer because they've made a new one.
Yes, the Jewel 20. So this is actually a combination of two circuits they already make, the AC20 and the Abbey, which are two takes on Vox amps. So what was really cool with Joe Morgan, when he actually got into building amps, he basically got a bunch of credit cards and bought loads of vintage amps, took them apart, learned how they were built, wrote down how the circuits were built, put the amps back together, sold them, paid off his credit cards, and did that for like years to kind of like get loads of different amps, to get loads of different ideas about how all these vintage Foxes, Marshalls, and Fenders were all built. So you've basically got a dual channel amp that you can actually run an A or a B or a Y. So you can actually run both channels at once, which is really cool. So they're EL84, so you get that kind of really nice, like, chimey top end, but you can really kind of drive it if you want to. And they've both got a switchable additional tube, which is the EF86. And I think this was one of the tubes that's built into some of the earlier Voxes. You've got a top boost channel, so you can add extra gain, standard bass and treble controls that you'd expect on a like Vox style amplifier, but you can run it down at a quarter a watt, or you can run it at 20 watts, which is quite nice. So if you really want to drive it at low volumes for recording, you can. Well, 20 watts gives you a little bit more headroom, but you can still crank it for a little bit of kind of top end breakup without being super loud. It's not like 50 or 100 watts. So yeah, if you're after that kind of chimey sort of Vox thing, this is absolutely perfect, basically.
I like that it's so specific. It's not like, yeah, we've done, you know, like the Boogie thing of like, yeah, we've done a Vox and a Marshall, or, you know, a Vox and a Fender. It was two very specific Vox amplifiers.
Yeah, so basically, channel one is just volume. Channel two is volume, treble and bass, and then you've got an overall power control, which is like a sweepable control, which basically I'm assuming it does something like sags the power to the valves, which is why you can vary the control. And then you've got the overall cut control for tone, which is like that tone control that sits after the power amp, basically. So yeah, I think this is really good, but this is where it would be something that's a fairly good pedal platform, especially if you use drive pedals in front, because you can get the headroom if you want. But if you're doing something more simple, or you're doing that kind of Brian May, you just want to boost it with a treble booster, you can, because your power level allows you to soak that power down and then crank the output. So yeah, definitely if you want a Vox, or a more boutique-y Vox, should I say, this is definitely a choice worth going
for. How much do Morgan amps cost? They're really expensive, right?
They're not actually that expensive. So I think my head, so I custom ordered mine. So it's a PR12, which is basically like a Princeton, comes in at about 18 watts with a reverb control. So it's just volume, bass, treble, and then it's got reverb, mix, and then it's got how much dwell time there is, so how much like splashiness you get. And I think retail, that was like $12.99.
Right, okay. So how much is this one going to be? That is actually okay. That's kind of in line, I guess, with sort of much more major brands.
I think this will probably be, they're not actually listing a price on the website, but to give you an idea, let's see if we can find something similar. So the AC20, which is one half of this circuit, is $12.99. So I think for something like that, you're probably going to be looking at like $19.99. Which I would say is probably about right.
Oh, it's a chunk of money. But yeah, you're right. It's, you know, I guess that's That's how much things cost.
They're very specific, though, aren't they? It's not like you're going in to just buy, you know, a Marshall head or whatever, or, you know, a Vox amp. You know, they're very, you've got to be a particular person to be buying, you know, a Morgan with this particular spec, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. I just think it's, if you want that sort of, I think it's nice to have that two channel sort of Voxiness about it, which is something you don't always necessarily get with a normal Vox unless you like, you know, jack the inputs. So I think it's nice to be able to blend both channels at once as well. I think that's quite a cool little feature. So yeah, I think it is fairly specific, but I think probably get a little bit more versatility out of it than a normal Vox just because of the extra tone switches you've got as well.
Yeah, cracking amp.
Yes.
Anyway, that is about all the time that we've got on the regular episode of the Guitar Nerds podcast.
We said we had loads of news, and then we got through about two news.
We absolutely have to continue the news on the Patreon, because I've just seen the names of the new Ernie Ball Slinky strings,
yes,
and I absolutely want to talk about them. The gauges are ridiculous.
Okay.
I want to make that the priority for the Patreon
episode. That's the
priority.
Okay, fine. Well, we're going to continue over there, where from as little as $1 a month, you can support the podcast. $1 a month gets you the regular episode ad-free and early. $5 a month gets you the Patreon special, where we're going to be talking all about Ernie Ball string gauges and loads of other things as well. And $10 a month makes you an executive producer and gets your name read out in a single breath by me. Ready?
Yep.
Jim Welter, Keith Adams, Steve Ferguson, Eric File, Christopher Franklin, Andy Joyce, John Englund, Adam Royce, Chris, Jay Cutmore, Robert Gussens, Rob Gruhl, Scott Hamilton, Tucker Amaton, Ernie Cooper, Ross Edwards, Nate Nagel, Stephen Ange, Rob Grant, Matt Roberts, Dave Lee, Amy James Baker, Juan Correa, Aaron Seven, Blake Wyland, Andrew Goody, Jamie Kemp, Jake Gray, Matt Bellamy, Martin Cliff, Scott Kennedy, Kirsten Loser, Christopher Loser, Hans and Scott Tane, Robin Smith, Derek Rich, Chris Connors, Rob Nordwick, Duncan Watson, Ed Bailey, Steve Merkel, DJ Marcos, Michael McBray, Carlos Spencer, Andy McKenzie, Matt Page, Blair Toms, Scott O'Brien, Laurie Anstis, Paul Corrigan, Will Clare, Moon Gravett, Will Thompson, Adrian Day, Ken Sayers, Matthew King, Scott Tate, Sean O'Bone, Chris O'Bone, my trumpet son.
Well, that was very close.
Yeah,
it was close.
Was there a new person added?
There were some new people added, but I also doubled a name up that I didn't think I'd quite... I gave Christopher Losa the second go because I sort of went... I didn't feel he was getting his money's worth. You know...
I absolutely cannot wait to talk about mammoth slinkies.
Yes, 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 they are. They do seem pretty weird.
It's going to be good.
Okay, we're gonna continue over there. We'll see you next week for more of this guitar nerdery. Farewell.
Bye.
Facebook.com/Guitar Nerds Forum.
Oh, wait, am I supposed to say all those things?
Yes, you are.
I didn't say,
don't worry about it. Cut it off now. We're done.
Okay.